From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, I really want to tell you how much I thank you for doing that. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
There's a very good chance you're not going to die.
As the world watches the relentless spread of the deadly coronavirus and our government, for one, deploys dubious tactics to inoculate itself, if not its citizens, from harm, others, including houses of worship, are stepping up. I'll talk to Religious News Service senior editor Yonat Shimon, who's written an insightful article headlined U.S. Chinese Churches on the Front Lines of Coronavirus Vigilance.
He could personally suck the virus out of every one of the 60,000 people in the world, swim to the bottom of the ocean, and spit it out, and he would be accused of pollution. There's nothing this president can do that will ever satisfy the people who hate him more than they hate the coronavirus.
Impeachment, scandal, plunging stock markets, global health crises. No matter what comes at the man, once known as the Teflon Don, the fans and followers of the President of the United States don't waver for even a moment. Just like virtually all of the members of his party holding public office, the Americans who voted Donald Trump into the White House are standing firm, according to new research by the Public Religion Research Institute. We'll get the thoughts of PRRI Director of Research, Natalie Jackson. But first,
really very expert at the field. And what I've done is I'm going to be announcing exactly right now that I'm going to be putting our Vice President Mike Pence in charge.
As the half-staffed Trump administration bumbles its way through a global pandemic, Thursday saw the abrupt appointment of a czar to manage the response, Michael Richard Pence. Even as the president fights the media instead of public health crisis, the Veep has some history from his time as governor of Indiana that seems very relevant. For expert insights, I'm very grateful to be able to call on Tom Lobianco, the author of the powerful book Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Tom, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know the vice president so well. What was your first thought when you heard about this sudden assignment he got?
Well, I can tell you that myself, other Hoosier observers, were kind of questioning whether he's the right fit for it. But he's not a terribly strong manager. And if you look at the composition of that task force, it's a managerial position, right? You're dealing with public health experts. You're dealing with national security experts. It's really something that needs to pull in all facets of the government. And Pence, I mean, from his time as governor, really even, you know, in the White House, too, to a lesser degree, he's just not a very strong manager. He's not the kind of guy who dictates an agenda. He's more conciliatory. And that's kind of what we were wondering when that was first announced on Wednesday. My understanding is that his role as the chair of this force is going to be, yes, they will be, all messaging will be run through him. The New York Times reported that out yesterday, which, you know, for this administration is probably a good thing. They don't seem to do very well with messaging. Mm-hmm. And certainly on a public health crisis, that's something you really, really, really need to be cognizant of. But he also is, at least according to my sources, he also is actually in control of the task force. Mm-hmm. Now, the question then becomes, what does he do running this thing, right? Mm-hmm. Is he very hands-on, or does he kind of let things run on autopilot? Can they run on autopilot? And that's kind of the question. I think that's the question that, you know, remains to be answered. I was looking at his schedule for today. He's on a trip to Florida, and he's doing three events. One event is a coronavirus discussion with Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis, and then the other two events are Republican fundraisers. I think that gives you a pretty good indication of how they will be handling this. You know, look, he's still out there campaigning. You know, yesterday he had the coronavirus roundtable, but he also gave a speech at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, which is, you know, ostensibly about running for president in 2024. At least that's what most people view it. And I think that's a pretty good indication of how he's going to run things.
So let me expand that a little bit. What does it tell us that the spin seems to be getting more priority than actual testing and containment?
Well, I think they're finally now starting to seriously address this. You know, I'm sure you probably saw that those reports from the whistleblower inside who used to work inside HHS, saying that the people who were bringing folks back in to the U.S., the first responders, so to say, in terms of handling people who had been infected in Wuhan, were not properly trained, were not wearing the proper equipment, possibly, you know, more than likely spreading this. So, you know, look, there's still a lot of questions about how they're going to handle this. And I think when people bring up the Mike Pence's response to the HIV outbreak in southern Indiana in 2015, I think there are some good parallels there. And I think there are some which are not so strong. I think one of the strong parallels in that is there's a delayed response. And when you're, you know, having a delayed response on things like this only allows it to be exacerbated. Now, you know, why was that a delayed response? Here, Trump just did not get on top of it. You know, you had different answers from different people. You had the CDC with a very narrow testing window in terms of determining who is infected with the coronavirus. You know, you had the president saying it wasn't that big a deal. Obviously, that's changed now. I guess he still says it's not that big a deal, but his actions seem to be showing that it is a fairly big deal.
Mm-hmm. Realistically, this assignment that he has is not likely to end well. Might that tarnish his options for the future?
It could. Look, if this goes poorly for him, I mean, if you're the vice president, you don't have a well-known portfolio. I think to those of us who pay attention to him closely, you know, he could tell you about his work in Venezuela, fighting Maduro, trying to get Juan Guaido installed down there, you know, is creation of this additional military branch, Space Force, you know, all those items. But I think for the general public, most people don't really know that much about him, right? You know, he's still kind of an unknown quantity and people are still learning about him. So this is probably, I would say, the most high profile position that he has gotten in his career. There's a lot of risk going on with that. Now, I will say, I don't know if this will be good or bad for him, because we haven't watched it happen yet. You know, look, the initial part with the analogy is with the 2015 outbreak, where in Indiana, where this basically it resurfaced a major problem that he had as governor. Mm-hmm. Well, that's bad for him, because now it forces what it is forcing. And I think it's good for us, the public, the people trying to make decisions. It's good to force an examination of his record. That's good. But what does that mean going forward? I don't know yet. I mean, it's still very early. We have to watch how he handles this. I know from his past management of government and just from, talking with folks around him that he is very hands-off. And I think that's what I would be watching for here. Oh, and he also, like most politicians, claims victory, whether or not he won.
I see. I don't have to tell you that Pence has a history with public health, specifically HIV, during his time as governor of Indiana. I'm curious to ask you, what do we need to know about that episode?
What happened there, look, there were kind of two parts to this. And it's really sad. I mean, the backstory on this is really sad. You know, look, there's a lot of there's opioid abuse, drug abuse throughout rural Indiana, like in much of the country. In 2014, November 2014, there was a woman who was a sex worker, a prostitute, working at a truck stop in southern Indiana, and was sharing one needle with, I think the number was upwards of 200 other truckers, people who were coming through there. And, it was a story. It's horrifying. I mean, I still cringe at it. They were, instead of using new needles, what they would do is, to save money, because they didn't have any money, was they would resharpen the old needle and then used it hundreds of times. It created an HIV outbreak down there. And now, look, this was at the end of 2014. Pence does not seriously get around to dealing with this until April of 2015. So it takes about six months. The New England Journal of Medicine, the Lancet, the British medical journal, did case studies of this afterwards, and they both determined that Pence, in his opposition to creating a needle exchange, and that this, if they had gone down there sooner, they might have stopped the spread of this just by doing clean needles. And, look, there's also an ideological opposition to this. And obviously, as a reporter, it's not for me to say, what's right or wrong. I will just say that, Pence also had an ideological opposition, which is he thinks, like some other conservatives, that if you do a needle exchange, that's promoting drug use. Possibly, but it was also, by not doing that, was definitely allowing for the spread of HIV. He was heavily criticized for taking too long on this. Now, I think the other part of this, which I have not seen talked about as much, which I think was a rampant thread throughout his time as governor, which actually you kind of see now too, is that he was spending a lot of time focused on his political ambitions. He was focused on running for president. Certainly through the end of 2014 and then again into the beginning of 2015, he was still trying to game out whether he could run for president in 2016. And what this created a problem for him with the HIV outbreak. It created a problem for him with the RFRA, the gay marriage battle that they had in 2015. Because he was not focused on his day job. He had one foot out the door. And, you know, look, these are tough issues. It's hard to be a chief executive. And you really, and that goes to, you know, whether you're Democrat or Republican. I used to cover Martin O'Malley in when he was Maryland's governor. And he kind of had the same problem. You know, people who, oftentimes the best governors are people who have no ambition because they're not focused on trying to win the next race.
Well, you know, and our listeners know, the reason that I ask you that question from times past, I ask that because I want our listeners to hear you talk about it and then figure out for themselves what they learned then that might have really important consequences as he does his work around the coronavirus now. And we'll let them do that. We know Pence views everything through his particular religious lens. Some end times believers have already claimed that this pandemic is a prophesied step toward the apocalypse. So could that in some way color the response from this government?
Oh, it could.
I wish you'd have said no.
I'm laughing, and I shouldn't laugh because this is some serious stuff, clearly. You know, and you know as well as anyone, I mean, look, we've had a return of people like Jimmy Baker selling his end times rations, the buckets of cornmeal. You know, if you want to buy a shelter and stock it with Jimmy Baker cornmeal, it's a part of the Trump phenomenon, right? It's part of the Trump era, right? We have this return of the end times, the prophesiers, Robert Jeffress and John Hagee also, in particular. I'll tell you with Pence, and you know, I wrote about this in the book, and to me it was kind of surprising, but I think it's also, the more I learned about him, the deeper I went, it made sense. Pence doesn't really buy into that. And you know, there's like among fundamentalists, among the broader evangelical set, there's a lot of debate over dispensationalism, you know, whether or not, you know, will the world come to the end as written in Revelations? You know, does that happen? What time, you know, are we living in? There's always going to be people that, you know, the end is nigh. right? You always kind of run into that. I will just say for Pence, though, when I was talking with his friends and advisors, two people in particular, one who used to practice with him in the 90s, and then another who is a current advisor, told me that he doesn't really buy into that, or at least they've never heard him talk about it very much. That's just not his style of practice. So then the question becomes, okay, why would Mike Pence headline an event at John Hagee's Christians United for Israel? And the answer is because he's pandering, I mean, at least according to this advisor. And, you know, look, there's very real things happen in response to this, right? Yeah. Because, you know, you move the embassy to Jerusalem, and now you're not talking, it's not an end of the world type thing exactly, but you know, there's real Middle East policy implications. I mean, you're instigating a large part of that world by doing that. You know, you can't have a serious Middle East peace plan as a result of that. That just it just doesn't work. And that's the real concern there.
Well, as the president and his supporters careen toward the 2020 elections, what should our listeners be keeping an eye on? And I guess the best way to ask that is, what are you keeping an eye on and paying really attention to, and the consequences that may come from what you see?
You know, number one, Russia, you brought Trump, Russia. Yeah, Russia is still involved in the election. They are still pushing disinformation. I will say, you know, as a reporter, as a journalist, I try not to advocate for anything, but I do feel good advocating for good and accurate information. And you know, for your folks, I mean, look, we've seen it on the right and the left. I mean, disinformation being pushed. It's the same thing that they did in 2016 with the same people. I mean, they pushed Sanders in opposition to Clinton. Just as much, well, not as much as they pushed Trump. They pushed Trump more in 2016, but we're seeing very similar dynamics. I would, you know, for your listeners, I would say be vigilant. If you read something on Facebook, maybe try to go outside of Facebook. Facebook is not, it has had a lot of problems in terms of the information published on there. Try to read as many sources as possible. You know, look, this was true before. Russia started meddling in the elections, you know, people always ask me, how do you know something? Well, you know, you don't always know 100%. I try to read like the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, New York Times, all trusted news sources. Try to read as many news sources as possible. It's really the only way to get a good read on things. And I guess be vigilant. You know, if something sounds intense or maybe a little too much, that's kind of hard to gauge in the Trump era. But, you know, take it outside of Facebook and try to check it out a little bit, because we are under attack with disinformation right now, unfortunately.
Yeah. Very good. Tom LoBianco is the author of Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. It's now available in paperback. Tom is a contributing writer at Vanity Fair and Yahoo News, and previously covered the Trump-Russia investigation for the Associated Press and for CNN. Before that, he spent years reporting from the Indiana State House and is uniquely knowledgeable on the past and the potential of Mike Pence. Tom, it's great to talk with you again. I always talk with you with a lot of joy. I appreciate you sharing your expertise with us, the counsel you give our listeners, and you're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Well, this is tons of fun. It's so much to go over, and always have a lot of fun talking with you.
Although the majority of new coronavirus cases is no longer being diagnosed in China, the world's focus on Wuhan as ground zero for the infection and how quickly the illness spread in that region inevitably linked it to people of Chinese origin, including Chinese Americans. As our government downplayed concerns and sent out conflicting messages, houses of worship stepped up. And a compelling read about that is headlined U.S. Chinese Churches on the Front Lines of Coronavirus Vigilance. The author is Religion News Service national reporter and senior editor Yonat Shimron, and I am really pleased to have her join us right now on State of Belief Radio. Yonat, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
About how many churches across the country serve predominantly Chinese congregations? Do you know?
I don't know exactly. Most Chinese Christian churches are non-denominational, and so it's very hard to know how many there are. We know that there are about 200 Chinese Christian churches that affiliate with the Southern Baptist Convention. Mm-hmm. There's probably a far larger number that are non-denominational, and then there's probably a good number of Presbyterian Christian churches that are mostly Chinese.
Are you very familiar with them? But they're not in the people are not hearing about them very much. Do you know a lot about them?
I don't know a lot about them, but I did talk to half a dozen pastors, mostly in the South. And so I I've been covering them off and on through the years. So I have a little bit of familiarity with them.
Yona, what steps do you see some of these churches taking in response to the current situation?
Well, they've really taken it upon themselves to be very cautious about the coronavirus and to implement all kinds of safety protocols. One church I visited in Cary, North Carolina, had a big, bold sign in yellow outside of the church doors. It was taped to the door saying attention in bold letters, and it warned members not to bring their children to the church if they have traveled abroad in the past 2 weeks. And I found that that was pretty typical of lots of Chinese Christian churches, in that they are self-quarantining themselves. Mm-hmm. In other words, if they've traveled abroad, particularly to China or to Asia more generally, they don't go to church for 2 weeks after they return to make sure that they're not contagious and that they're not carrying the virus. It's less an issue now because the United States has most of the major airline carriers are no longer traveling to China. And it's been several weeks that that's been the case. So there's not a way to travel back and forth anymore. At least initially, that was the case. And now that the virus spread to other countries outside of China, it may be that these churches are continuing to take these precautions.
I think it's noteworthy how quickly some faith leaders stepped up to address this new and unexpected challenge. In speaking with some of them, what did you hear about that?
Yeah, I mean, they really have done a wonderful job. They're very civic-minded. A lot of the Chinese Christian churches that I've spoken to, and very law-abiding, and they have made a lot of, they've canceled a lot of events, a lot of Sunday school classes, a lot of, very often in Chinese Christian churches, after services on Sunday, they'll gather for a meal, fellowship meal, and a lot of these meals have been canceled. They've taken a lot of creative steps to keep the congregation going. But for example, I talked to some churches that have started to meet online for Sunday school rather than in person. Mm-hmm. Some churches have decided to change the way they do communion. Instead of drinking from a common cup, for example, they'll have these prepackaged vials of grape juice in a wafer. They're individually packaged and hand those out instead. So they've done a very good job of taking all the precautions necessary to avoid contagion.
I think if I'm right, that you pointed out that in some Chinese churches, as many as 50% of the congregation just has dropped off and is not going to the building.
That's right. It's gotten a little better. That was initially when the outbreak began, which was around, by the way, the outbreak began around the Chinese New Year, which is a time when many Chinese Americans fly back to China to celebrate the holiday with their family and loved ones. And so this year, that was kind of a lot of those celebrations were canceled. But many of these Christians decided they to stay away from church just in case. Those numbers though are beginning to climb back up. But yes, initially about half the congregation didn't show up.
Have you, in your conversations with the people in the Chinese churches, have you heard any of them comment about how the government is supporting them in this time, or how the government is not supporting them in this time? Have they talked about that at all?
They didn't. The only agency I think they've been in touch with are the Centers for Disease Control, and they've been following their guidelines very closely and implementing them in their churches. But I don't think, other than the Centers for Disease Control, I don't think they've been in touch with anyone else.
How are faith leaders helping congregants deal with actual personal loss of loved ones at a time when it is so difficult to muster perhaps the most important component for healing, and that is community support?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of the churches that I spoke to said that they knew members who were intimately affected by the coronavirus. I spoke to a pastor in Richmond, Virginia, who told me that one of the members of his congregation lost her father to the coronavirus in Wuhan. And she was not able to travel back for his funeral because there are no flights going back there. So it's been a very difficult time, and the church has really tried to support her and offer comfort and fellowship with her. But I know that this is true of a lot of Chinese Christian churches. I was speaking to another woman who attends a Chinese Christian church in Raleigh, North Carolina, where some of her classmates, she is from China, and her classmates were living in Wuhan and affected by the virus, and tried to send them face masks and other supplies in the mail, and has been in constant contact with them through the Chinese mobile app called WeChat, which is how they use to communicate.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear any of the faith leaders talk about cooperation, active cooperation with public health agencies in the country?
I did not hear. I mean, I know that a lot of these Chinese Christian churches are, you know, have very educated members, and there are doctors on their amid the congregation who are members, and I know that they've consulted with physicians that are members. I don't know to what extent they've reached out beyond, much beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of how other churches have related to Chinese churches in this time of crisis?
Yeah, I don't. I was really amazed by how much they've taken on by themselves. I know that the Southern Baptist Convention has been had a phone call with many of the Chinese churches that affiliate with them and prayed for them. The, one of the administrators of the Southern Baptist Convention held a call with many of the leaders of their churches to do that. But so they've been in contact, you know, to the extent that they are denominationally affiliated. I think the denomination has offered a lot of support.
We talked about the fact that this is now spreading. We don't know exactly what the end of it is going to be. Have you seen other houses of worship preparing themselves and their members as this virus moves across geographic and ethnic lines with such ease?
Only anecdotally, I know that that's happening, and it will continue to happen. I imagine that certainly communion might change the way that communion is done. But I know that in other countries, we had a report from Rome about how the coronavirus is affecting Lent and Ash Wednesday, which was 2 days ago, over there. Because Italy has had is beginning to feel the effects of the coronavirus with many people infected, and I imagine that in the United States this is to the extent that the virus grows here, I'm sure there will be more of a reaction. Churches will take on much more of a role, and they can look to their Chinese Christian neighbors for guidance.
Writing about this now just over a month into the pandemic, what did you hear or what did you discover that had the most impact on you? What is there a story? Is there an image that stayed with you from what you found in your reporting?
Well, I go back to that story of this one woman who, unfortunately, I couldn't talk to, but I was just struck by how terrible it must be to lose a loved one abroad and not be able to go back and attend the funeral. That just struck me as so touching and so heartbreaking. It's a crisis that the pandemic, if it is a pandemic, it's certainly an epidemic, is going to reach out and touch all of us, I think, in some ways. And I can only hope that it might unite us as well.
Yonat Shimron is national reporter and senior editor at Religion News Service, which offers nonpartisan, nonsectarian, nonprofit coverage of really the most important religious stories of our time. You can find her article, U.S. Chinese Churches on the Front Lines of Coronavirus Vigilance, online at religionnews.com. Yonat, thank you so much for giving us some time and being with us to help us better understand what's going on here. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Despite chaos and controversy, Trump favorability stable throughout 2019. Now that's the headline of a new report from the respected Public Religion Research Institute. And as always, it's rich with insights into the groups and groupings that add up to the result as a whole. Joining me now with some of the highlights is PRRI Director of Research, Dr. Natalie Jackson. Natalie, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, thank you for having me.
For a lot of people, this unshakable level of support seems impossible to understand. But on the other hand, you also found equally unshakable levels of disapproval on the other side of the aisle, didn't you?
Yes, that's right. Views of President Trump are very polarized on several dimensions, not just by party. And the opposition is just as strong as the support.
It's white Christians every time, isn't it, Natalie? Talk about the impact this demographic group continues to have on these numbers.
President Trump's favorability is definitely bolstered by white Christians. The highest support, of course, comes from white evangelical Protestants. 64% of them view him favorably. Mormons are also above 50%. 55% of Mormons view the president favorably. And then it drops slightly under half for white Catholics, white mainline Protestants, and the mostly white group of Orthodox Christians. So those are at 48 and 49%. So certainly well above the national average, even among the smallest groups. Our national average throughout 2019 was 41% favorable. So, you know, he's definitely getting a consistent boost from all of the white Christian groups, but it's largest among evangelicals.
Well, there can be no question that this administration is laser-focused on keeping its promises to at least this part of its base. I'm curious, though, at this point, what percentage of our population roughly belongs to this white Christian cohort as identified here?
It's hovering around 40% of the country. White evangelical Protestants are about 15%, and the other groups make up about another quarter. Certainly that's lower than it has been in years past. We're seeing a steady decline of white Christians relative to the entire population. And so, but it's still a very large group, you know, 40% of the country that votes regularly at very high turnout levels is a pretty powerful coalition, even if their numbers are declining.
Mm-hmm. Well, what other groups are contributing to this unwavering level of support?
Well, obviously Republicans. those are the clearest ones. We have 79% of Republicans showing favorable views of Trump throughout 2019. We did a follow-up just a couple of weeks ago in the middle of February, and Republicans were up to 84% favorability on Trump. So, you know, it looks like there is kind of an effect of, you know, maybe starting to come home prior to the election, as we often see in election year data. The other groups that are pretty strong for Trump, we pulled out in the report everyone who was a majority favorable, you know, with the average being 41%. If a group got above 50%, that showed that they were pretty substantially above the average. And not surprisingly, it's variations on white subpopulations, white men are 55% favorable, white Americans without a college degree. Sometimes this group's referred to as working class Americans. The whites among that group are 52% favorable. Mormons, as I mentioned, are also above 50%. Mm-hmm. And older white Americans, over 50, reached that majority status. 53% of white Americans over 50 view Trump favorably. So in general, it's an older white religious coalition. We put a regression model in the report, which is a fancy way of saying we accounted for everything all at once, to look at what contributes most to being a strong supporter of Trump. And, you know, that's what we got back. Even accounting for everything else, the most likely people to hold favorable views of Trump are Republicans, conservatives, older people, white people. There's a little bit of an interesting thing. It's the lowest income and then the very highest income people. So people that make more than $200,000 a year, kind of Trump's sort of peer group in that respect, also show a little bit higher support.
That's interesting.
And rural Americans.
Yeah. This president always defines damaging news. Accusations of corruption, the impeachment process, even the current coronavirus crisis in terms of partisanship. Any bad news is a coordinated attack on him. But looking at your findings, I don't see any bump in sympathy support, just like there are no lasting drops in support. We're stuck, aren't we?
It's amazing, isn't it? It's, you know, one of the things that didn't make it into the report was we did a comparison to Obama's favorability ratings in his third year of his presidency to match, you know, this is the third year of Trump's presidency. And there was considerably more movement in Obama's numbers. And he hovered over 50% generally favorable. So we are seeing a very different phenomenon here. You know, in the report, we have the first chart that notes the Mueller report on the possible Russian coordination as a place where Trump's favorability kind of dips for a little bit, mm-hmm. and then it comes right back to the average. The impeachment inquiry announcement really didn't have a large effect. The impeachment charges didn't have a large effect. And, you know, like I said, we reran one more number 2 weeks ago after the conclusion of the impeachment trial, and we got basically the same numbers. Mm. Again, Republicans had gotten a little bit more favorable toward him, and Democrats, conversely, got a little bit less. Yeah. But overall, things looked identical. Nothing shakes views of Trump. They're just very, very deeply ingrained at this point.
From everything that you've seen, do you think it's a matter of such entrenched loyalties that nothing can shake them on either side? Or is it possible there are stimuli that have not been tested yet? Because if this is indeed a permanent level of approval, there's no motivation at all to rein in any impulse this president might yet have.
You know, he made the joke when he was running that he could shoot someone on mm-hmm. Fifth Avenue in New York and mm-hmm. not lose any supporters. And I think most of us observing the campaign thought that was a pretty extreme and unrealistic statement. However, I think we're seeing something similar to that. You know, it would take completely turning on his base in a substantive policy way, mm-hmm. you know, suddenly upending his support for conservative views and completely changing his entire governing attitude mm-hmm. to really shake these beliefs loose. Because what these people are seeing is that, okay, personally, he has some things they disagree with, but as far as what he's doing as president, he's getting judges into place that are conservative and support conservative views. He's pushing back and undoing a lot of restrictions on pollution and air control and, you know, things that conservatives and really free market type people have not liked over the last mm-hmm. 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, he pushes back on LGBT rights. And so they see that he's promoting an agenda that they like, so they're willing to overlook all of the personal flaws. And so as far as, you know, his personal life, I'm honestly not sure what would shake, mm-hmm. you know, these views loose.
Yeah. I'm interested in whether through the years, have you ever seen this kind of rock solid consistency on any similar volatile issue as this administration?
I have not. You know, we have presidential approval and polling numbers back to Harry Truman from Gallup. Mm-hmm. And in general, public opinion has been a much more volatile thing. And there are two forces, I think, at play here that it's impossible to know which is more responsible for what we're seeing now. One is that we were already on this polarization track. You know, even before Trump, the parties were becoming more entrenched in their respective corners, and the public was responding to that. At the same time, Trump has really been a solidification of that. So, you know, there are these two forces, Trump and overall polarization, coming together to make this just a very sticky, to use your word, stuck, public opinion issue.
The American Values Atlas is an incredibly comprehensive profile of this nation and its people. If we take the chart generated by this look at support for the president, are there any other areas where we see Americans respond in similarly consistent ways? And if that is true, who are those Americans?
Well, most of the other issues we do in the American Values Atlas are substantive and not about politicians. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're going to have a large report coming out on out of the American Values Atlas on LGBT issues later on in March. And, you know, we released a similar one last year, and we see generally the same kind of groupings. Mm-hmm. Pro-LGBT rights, you know, we have the more liberal groups. Anti, we have more conservative groups. The unique thing about LGBT issues is, particularly with same-sex marriage, has been the increase in support for it over the last 15 years. Basically, it's upended. It's gone from about 30% support to about 30% not supporting over that time period. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we do tend to see more movement in substantive policy issues simply in response to how society moves.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Natalie Jackson is Director of Research at the Public Religion Research Institute, the work of which is only growing in importance as the power of the political religious right grows in this country. The report we've been talking about today is titled "Despite Chaos and Controversy, Trump's Favorability Stable Throughout 2019." You can find it, along with a treasure trove of other valuable research, at PRRI.org. Natalie, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for what you're doing. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Great. Thank you for having me.
On Wednesday, February 27th, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform held a hearing on the grave risks facing LGBTQ plus persons as the political religious right relentlessly fights to redefine the cornerstone principle of religious liberty. I was honored to be asked to submit testimony to the committee, and at the urging of my producer, I'd like to share those thoughts with you. It is my distinct honor to submit the following testimony as part of today's hearing entitled "The Administration's Religious Liberty Assault on LGBT Rights." My name is Reverend Dr. C. Welton Gaddy, President Emeritus of Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a national nonpartisan organization that celebrates true religious freedom, promotes policies that protect the integrity of both religion and democracy, and ensures that all Americans are treated equally under the law. I've also served as a pastor in a Baptist church for over 50 years. As you would expect, over the course of my ministry, I have shared burdens of great sadness along with great joy. I have heard the admonishments of my brethren who condemn LGBTQ plus people and question their faith simply for who they are. And I have listened to a young man, trembling with fear, tell me with certainty that he would lose his job at a bank if his boss learned of his sexual orientation. But these moments of pain, of condemnation and fear, are paired with the abiding joy of supporting others along their path. Happily, I spent a great deal of time with a same-sex couple who, deeply in love, wanted to become members of our church. The day that I baptized the two, as they came out of the water, I saw in their faces looks that told me that for the first time in their lives, they felt like human beings. I share these experiences because in legislative chambers and courtrooms across the country, a great deal of our public discourse is taking place at the intersection of equality and religious liberty. Today's hearing is an important moment to step back and examine this topic as those who seek to drive a wedge between those two fundamental principles of our democracy only succeed in damaging both. I sincerely believe that religious freedom, as guaranteed to every American by the First Amendment, is in greater danger today than at any time since those protections became a part of our founding document. The reason for my alarm is a concerted effort by certain groups with strong allies in the current administration to redefine religious freedom away from the shared right to believe as we choose without fear of coercion or exclusion, toward a means to impose one's religious convictions on others. For instance, Interfaith Alliance, along with allies across the political and religious spectrum, championed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. As a necessary means to protect members of minority faiths and other marginalized groups. But in the years since its passage, RFRA has become a touchstone in the campaign to distort religious freedom and harm the very people it was enacted to protect. The law has been cited by employers to deprive workers of much-needed health care under the Affordable Care Act, illustrated by Burkwell v. Hobby Lobby Stores, Inc., as well as in hiring and firing decisions unrelated to a candidate's job performance, as in R.G. G.R. Harris Funeral Homes, Inc., v. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission before reaching the Supreme Court. In various court cases and a multitude of regulations proposed by the current administration over the last 3 years, proponents weaponize a distorted notion of religious freedom that shifts the balance of power toward those with a particular set of religious beliefs and away from vulnerable individuals who live, love, and worship differently. Just last week, 8 federal agencies concluded public comment periods on proposed changes to the requirements for faith-based entities that receive government funds. If enacted, these rules would permit publicly funded entities to exclude the very same taxpayers who foot the bill for their services simply for failing to pass an agency's religious test. LGBTQ plus Americans have already seen their ability to work, participate in their communities, and care for their loved ones vastly curtailed under this dangerous redefinition of religious freedom. Faced with the formidable power of the judicial and executive branches of our government, I'm reminded of the fear in the voice of the young man who sought my counsel as he risked losing his livelihood simply because of his sexual orientation. Our conversation took place far from the machinations of the Supreme Court. Our conversation took place far from the machinations of the Supreme Court or the bureaucratic intricacies of federal administrative agencies. But the consequences of their decisions and yours will redound in the lives of millions of LGBTQ plus Americans for decades to come. Surely, the nation I have loved and served all of my life, with respect and patriotism, will affirm the truths embedded in our Constitution. No person in our nation should be deprived of freedom and justice simply because of who they are. As esteemed members of Congress and of this committee, I ask you now to remember your oath of office, to zealously guard our democracy, to advance the aims of our founding document, and to cherish the abundant diversity that enriches our national character. Above all, I ask you to recommit yourselves to protecting our first freedom as defined for centuries, the freedom to believe as we choose, with the secure knowledge that no other person nor the government would use faith as a weapon against us. This is the religious freedom that I and so many Americans cherish. Thank you for the opportunity to submit testimony on this important matter. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, thank you so much for doing that. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, help us with that. Please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. You know what? Another way you can help us. You can help us by telling other people about this show. Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. Do it on social media or in person. It is incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at this time. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.